This is the sound of turning ideas into software. This is the sound of engineering and passion. Work. Work more. Work harder. Experiment. Build. Break. And build again. Write code. Improve it. Job done. Celebrate. Insurance, finance, retail, defense, robotics, energy. Amethyx.
Welcome back to another episode of Data Science at Home podcast. I'm Francesco, podcasting from the Byte Nook and Brussels Central. This is Data Science at Home podcast. I'm your host for the next 30 minutes or so. But today I'm not alone. In fact, I'm with Mike and Jim. Hi, Mike. I'm Jim. How are you doing today?
Hey, we're good. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so basically, Mike and Jim are in fact an acquaintance of mine online, because very recently I found a post somewhere. I don't remember where, but we'll ask them. And the post was about artificial intelligence and video game development, which is super cool topic. So I invited them to this show to discuss a bit about AI and games. And that's because, of course, both Mike and Jim have a common hobby, which is video games and video game development. Is that right, Mike?
That's right. We find it pretty fun. And we're also learning a lot along the way building games.
Cool. So feel free, guys, to give an intro of yourself to the listeners of Data Science at Home podcast. I'm sure they're going to be very intrigued to know who you are.
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Mike. And as my day job, I work at a health technology company. But I have a lot of hobbies around computing and programming. And so one of them is around this sort of, I think, coming up on 2-year hobby project. It's a video game called Solar Captains, and it's available on a platform called itch.io. It's a fully 3D naval combat game set in space, and I'm sure Jim will talk about that as well. And then I think you may have heard of us through an article I wrote on a website called AImodels.fyi, which is the most complete search engine to help you find AI tools and models for your project. And I also write the newsletter for that periodically. So there's a couple articles around AI and games, and I think we'll get a chance to talk about that today as well.
Sure. I think that was it. Sorry, Jim, go ahead.
Okay, that's nice. I think I said something earlier, but yeah, my mic was muted. So I'll say hi to everyone now. Hi, everyone, you know. But yeah, so my background is it's more or less basic, computer science and statistics. Definitely, I'm out. Definitely, I'm the weakest here in these fields, right? Mike is definitely a little bit stronger, and Francesco is also a little bit stronger. But I'm working on this game, Solar Captains, and mostly I do the development in Blender, which sometimes involves some programming. And I have a bunch of hobbies, but they're not all pertinent here. So we don't have to get into that. So
all right.
But mostly Blender. Well,
Blender, cool. And yeah, probably we'll speak about that. I mean, at least when it comes to creating assets, we're gonna discuss a few things later about Blender or 3D editors, for sure. That's pretty cool. I mean, I think I remember now AI models, FYI, and some other links on the internet. But of course, we'll report some of these important links in the show notes of this episode, as always, on the official website, datascienceathome.com. You know that every episode has a bunch of lines that is the show notes. And there we put, of course, all the material that have been announced or mentioned during the episode, and HIO and many other links we'll discuss today, they'll be there. All right. Well, I guess that we can start getting technical because, practitioners and AI aficionados are there and they're waiting for us to become technical. So let's do that. Well, let's discuss a bit about the way games, video games, of course, are developed today.
Yeah, and Jim and I can definitely share our process as well. But as we sort of started on this project, you know, the basic process of video game development, as we saw it, was, you know, initially a creative process. So just sort of figuring out the context of the game and how you wanted it to work and what did you want it to do. And then we actually created what's called a game design document. And this basically outlined the core mechanics of the game, the central premise, a high level summary of the game and what made it unique. And from this document, which in a lot of ways mirrors some of the technical specs that you might use if you were building a new software product, we were able to start working on an architecture. I started doing a lot of the coding and Jim started creating assets. And then there was just a lot of back and forth, a lot of testing and a lot of modification. As we learned what worked and what didn't work, we had to stay very closely synchronized to make sure that we didn't design something and paint ourselves into a corner. So there's just a lot of back and forth between the coding piece and the asset piece and the testing piece.
Right. Well, in fact, if I can add something, and probably Jim want to take it from there, I appreciate a lot when you mentioned it's first a creative process, because I believe that there is some kind of, you know, writing the story of the game, right? Before even getting to the keyboard and start writing code or even building assets. So that's probably the most creative and human, you know, the human aspects of video game development.
Well, that's really the meat and potatoes of the matter, right? Without the creative, like impetus, it's kind of like, what are we doing here, you know? And yeah, that's I'm sure that will, you know, we'll get back to that idea when we get into like the kind of like the implications of like, I don't know, increased automation and this type of thing.
Exactly.
But okay, I don't want to get, you know, too off track or too like schizophrenic, right? Like that's something you don't want to do when you go on a podcast is ramble schizophrenically. You know, I say that and then I'll say something like, well, actually, I think I'm going to undermine some of what Mike said. Not that he said anything wrong in particular, but I think the question you asked was more about, it was more general. It was like, how are games developed in like a general capacity? And definitely what Mike said is true for the for like the indie experience. I think that's very I think, you know, if there's anyone out there listening who's like, you know, starting their own project or who has been on their own small independent team, that's probably a very relatable experience, as Mike outlined. But of course, you know, with the larger outfits, it's quite different. So I don't know if you wanted to get into those specifics, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll try to squeeze this as much as we can in the 30 minutes that we have. But the reason I'm asking about the creative process is that, you know, when we talk about artificial intelligence as an, you know, integration with game development engines or game development in general, and the combination of artificial intelligence and game development, you know, the first, let's say, the first thing that people pay attention to is like, okay, how can you automate the creative process of building a video game? So I believe there are, first of all, some, let's say, low-hanging fruit of how AI can contribute or benefit to game developers. Maybe you want to mention some?
Yeah, I have a few ideas, and I think Jim may have a few as well. I think the first is actually around code, and it's kind of natural for me to go there since that's what I work on mostly for our project. The most recent GPT-4 model that's used, and ChatGPT, is probably one of the best coding assistant tools out there. There's a new model called Claude 3 from Anthropic that's also very strong in this area. And between those two, I have been able to work in a programming language that I really didn't know much to start when I started this project. And all of our code is written through this sort of human-directed use of AI. So essentially, I can provide it just a description of the code and also, I think most importantly, the architectural context. and get a file back, run it, and then test it in the game and iterate on that. So I think that's a very low-hanging fruit because most games are built of components that are not unique to that game. So most game scripts will handle things like movement, user input, maybe pathfinding. And so creating those is pretty straightforward. And the challenge is really to get them all together into one place. And so if you can offload the task of writing those scripts to the AI, and as a human, just basically conduct the symphony, then you can achieve a lot in a very short amount of time. And that's how we built a lot of our underlying code. I'm not sure if Jim has any ideas on sort of like the asset creation side, but that would be more his area.
Yeah. Jim, please go ahead, complete the picture on the asset creation. Then I have a question for both, but please
go. Okay. It's kind of, I think like AI and automation of like, you know, the creative process, it's a little bit more kind of like acidic or maybe troublesome, just like, you know, even as a concept for the more artistic, right? Because it's starting to like really erode at like the original impetus, right? It's kind of starting to steal the show. And the lack of like, kind of like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like soul, right? It starts to become a little bit more apparent in the in these like generated items. So an example is like, so we have, we want to do like little portraits for some of, like the captains and solar captains, right? And I'm not the best illustrator. And of course, our project is pretty ambitious for like the two of us. So it's like, there's too much work to be done. And it would be nice if like something could be, you know, if this could be automated, right? Or if something right. could be automated, just make it easier. Because yeah, it's just a lot to make a game, but especially a 3D game and so on. But the problem is, it's not really that the AI can't generate like for example the 2D icons that we wanted. It's just it doesn't fit, right? Like by itself the icon's fine, but things have to be consistent in when you make a game. Everything has to be consistent. It's not just enough that it's good by itself, it has to fit together. And it just kind of what we use the yeah, the generated pictures that we got, they just kind of felt kind of like plastic, or at least that was my take for it. They were like accomplished, but it was, the artifice was kind of palpable and intrusive, right? So that's like a kind of like a larger concern for right. the more artistic, but it's not always that way, right? Because sometimes in the pipeline for 3D, there are like more like lower hanging fruit or stuff like related to the generation of like terrain and things like that, or generation of like kind of like I don't know if lumpy is the word, but like yeah, lumpy geometry kind of things that are not quite as artistic, but need to be done. So we did right. look into that for terrain generation, and yeah, basically I had used AI as a kind of a like a consultant on how to set up stacks of modifiers and some generated geometry, right? And it was less problematic there. That's my experience with it. Okay,
so you're saying, well, you're actually saying what an artist would say, would claim, for example, as art without a soul, if it is kind of generated and looks more plastic or, you know, more artificial. Probably these are things that are going to improve, I believe, in the near future. We have seen the GPT family of models, you know, improving on a weekly basis, even though sometimes we have the feeling, especially on large language models for NLP, that actually these models are not improving at all, actually quite the opposite. I have a question for Mike regarding the code assistant, let's say, of a large language model, of a GPT model. We know that video games, for example, are, you know, require extremely efficient code, would that be something that, you know, someone can be giving up in case it requires the aid of an artificial intelligence, or is it not a problem?
Absolutely. You're right that it's a risk. And I think one thing that I benefited from in going through this process was that I had a lot of software development experience from other projects before. And so I could kind of look at the code and look for what they call like code smells, right? So examples of overly complicated components or, you know, examples where, for example, the AI tends to use expensive types of ways of searching the entire scene for a particular object, where it really should just cache that object on scene load rather than checking every frame. And so a large part of the role of a human is to act as almost like a critic of the software that the AI is writing, or to remember that the AI can be also directed to criticize its own work. There's been a lot of instances where the code I've implemented would cause performance decreases. And then when I'd pull up the profiler, I'd see that it was actually very obvious that like that was not the way to do it. And I'd have to go explain to the AI that the code it wrote was very non-performant and basically tell it to do better. And so that's definitely something you have to watch out for. And it's not just in game development. I think that's across the board. And I think it's very risky for maybe not junior developers who actually question a lot of things, but intermediate developers who feel very confident that they're going in the right direction and who might, you know, get so excited with the amount of code that they're writing that they lose the ability to criticize it. that's where the real danger is, right?
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you say this because on this show, we have been telling this a number of times, of course, not related to video games, but to coding in general. And we found exactly the same, you know, observations that indeed the code that is generated by an AI, you know, it better be criticized or supervised by a senior developer who actually knows what they're doing. So, you know, using junior or not, it's more like using blindly generated code is always, you know, a danger, and right. Probably in video game development, and definitely critical systems is even more of a danger because, you know, that code maybe cannot guarantee real time or near real time constraints or memory footprint and many other optimizations and efficiency that you might be losing in case, you know, you have an AI that just, you know, spits tokens that we call code. So, okay, that's the same risk. So nothing changed there. There is one thing that actually that we found online, especially in your article, which is a GameGPT. It's a new framework that has been developed, of course, by combining, you know, the GPT family of models with video game development. So I guess I'm going to give you the stage again, Mike or Jim, or Mike and Jim, to give us a bit of an overview of the GameGPT framework and, of course, how it aims to streamline game development processes in general.
Sure. I can give an overview, and I think Jim can kind of sketch out maybe some of the pros and cons of how this proposed overview could work. So GameGPT is actually, if you Google it, you'll find a lot of different options. It seems to be like a very common name for projects, but there is a project. there's a project that has a paper that I reviewed on my website that basically proposes automating the different roles that people traditionally play in the game development process. So they propose using basically a ChatGPT model, a GPT-4 model, I believe, to replace the development manager, the reviewer, the role of the development engineer, a game engine engineer, and a testing engineer. And in each of these roles, they create instead what's called an agent. And that agent has a set of instructions that sort of match the job description of each of these roles. And the envisioned structure is one where, rather than having all these different people work on a team together, a user through a front end sends a prompt that then goes through a planning process between the development manager agent and the reviewer agent. And then from there gets broken down into tasks by the engineer agents. And then from there, it gets turned into code. And then there is a sort of like a testing or critical process that looks at the code and compares it to the tasks and the planning, and then can identify that, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the code, it needs to be reworked. And then it kind of loops back, or it moves on to the next task. So that's the proposed model, basically replacing all of these people with AI. I think there are pros and cons to that. And maybe Jim could talk about, you know, some of the benefits and drawbacks to that approach.
Well, you know, I think, again, you guys are a little bit more knowledgeable on this than I am, but I can definitely see a problem with just kind of like, well, when you make a game, everything, it's as I said, the large picture has to fit the small picture, and the small picture has to fit the large picture. So there's like this, like somebody needs to really understand not just the scope of like all of the code and all of the art and, you know, all of the game mechanics, but like the art style as well. And it's hard to imagine all of that could be automated, right? Someone has to have like the main idea. And I don't know, like, again, it's you can't totally automate creativity, right? Maybe, right? Like, hopefully not. So that's maybe a naive response, kind of as like a stand-in for some of the listeners, or maybe not. Maybe the listeners actually, you know, the audience, they know more. So I don't know.
Well, it's quite dramatic knowing that, you know, this GameGPT and probably many other frameworks that will come in the future, you know, they have the, not tendency, but kind of the ultimate goal of replacing a number of people in a typical game development team with a GPT model. I definitely hope that's not the reason of the layoffs that we had in many of the you know, big players in IT in the world. For sure, it gives, you know, opens the, let's say, the doors to some form of democratization with respect to, for example, AAA game studios. I'm not saying that in your little room somewhere, wherever, you can challenge AAA game studios. You know, probably not. Probably with a story, for sure. You know, that creative moment that you can have, and that can be comparable to what a AAA game studio, you know, can reach. But of course, when it comes to workforce bandwidth and also, you know, compute power and much more, of course, you know, the competition is quite unfair. But the fact that, you know, we have, or we start seeing some AI agents that, let's say, support the already senior developer and speed up consistently the, you know, writing code, and at least for those functions and modules that are reusable, so to speak, well, that could give some additional advantage, let's say, to the small studios, right?
Definitely. I think the trend that we're seeing overall is that AI is a useful tool to increase the productive capacity of an individual human. I don't think we've yet seen it replace everything a human can do, but it can automate a lot of things that a human can do. And so, you know, the point that you're making, I think, is a very valid one. And if there is a minimum threshold in terms of code and features to make a game, which there almost always is, then AI can pick up a lot of that and give a team of just two people working, you know, at most a couple hours a week in their free time, like Jim and I, the opportunity to deliver an actual finished product that people have fun playing.
Nice. No, this is really cool. I mean, to think that we will get there soon, I mean, I'm pretty sure about that. Now, I want to go back one sec to the GameGPT framework again, because there is one concern that you have raised in your discussion, on your article, which is the lack of quantitative evaluations or, let's say, experimental results that demonstrate, in fact, the performance of GameGPT. And I have to be honest, as a researcher, former researcher myself, this is kind of a trick that many researchers do all the time, not just for machine learning and artificial intelligence, but pretty much in all sectors. It's not to hide something, but it's just not to say the full story and probably get the paper published. Now, I'm not judging here the authors. I'm not saying that. But, you know, not reporting experimental results for such a thing is, in my opinion, a big lack. And I'm glad that you also noticed that. I was also looking for it when I read the document, the paper. Now, the question I want to ask you is, can you elaborate a bit on the reasons behind, you know, this, and also discuss plans for future validation of the effectiveness of a framework, not just GameGPT, but in fact all AI based frameworks that we might be seeing in the future.
Sure. So just for some additional context, I tend to cover at least 2 to 3 papers a week on my website. And I spend a lot of time reading papers on Arxiv and on other platforms. And one thing that's been consistent in the last few months is that there has been a very strong bias towards publishing research that does not include either the code base or the full data set for scrutiny. And I'm not sure entirely what's driving that, but I would say that likely there's just so much interest in the topic of AI and so much pressure to get something out there that a lot of partial results have been published. I often find myself confused, for example, to read on the same day papers that claim completely opposite findings with the same model. Neither of which will show all the methodology. And so a big thing I try to adhere to in writing my summaries is to look critically and say if we really have something here or if we don't. And in the case of GameGPT, this paper, I did not find a lot of information on how the results were actually generated. No numerical or quantitative examples I could really find. Not to say that these researchers didn't find something interesting here. They very well could have, but just that it would have been helpful to have a little bit more information about the result. And I think that this is actually especially common in these sort of agent-driven frameworks, where we essentially propose automating different sort of job descriptions with an LLM system. I find those frameworks to be very brittle on the interface between the agents, in part because the responses are somewhat non-deterministic. So you can't really fully plan for in your prompting some of the responses that LLMs might pass into each other and then to a third LLM, right? I was very curious to see how these researchers solved that problem, and I didn't feel like I got a very clear sense of that in this paper. And you actually see it all over the place. There's, if you're on Twitter, there's, at the time we're recording this, a lot of conversation about a tool called Devin, which is a tool to automate software development. And I believe it also uses something like an agent framework. There's very strong demo videos and really interesting speculation. But I think until people can actually either play with the tool or until the architecture is released with some quantitative measurements, it's very hard to say how effective these tools will actually be.
Sounds good. And the concept of full automation in game development, we have already said that it raises some eyebrows and questions about the role of human creativity and innovation. I guess I want to ask, how would an artificial intelligence balance automation with the need for originality and inventive game design?
Yeah, I mean, now my head just spins because I'm trying to keep up with, you know, large language models and whatnot. And now that's kind of like we're jumping into the philosophical deep end. So it's so
it is what it is.
That's 100% true. Yeah, I mean, I think like the AI kind of has to be as a kind of more ancillary or supplemental or supportive in a supportive role. Otherwise, it will threaten to kind of usurp the central idea of a game. And it kind of has to be subordinate to someone's creative vision. And as long as that's the case, the originality shouldn't suffer too much. But if that's not the case, then I don't really see originality being preserved. Although maybe the results would still be impressive in a certain sense, you know.
Well, there is, in fact, one, let's say, observation that we have to do about the collaboration between human developers and AI systems. That, you know, it seems like a trend, but I strongly believe it's going to stay for some time, for sure. You know, this collaboration will become more tighter and tighter between, let's say, human developers and AI systems. And as AI systems, of course, you know, keep improving on the narrow tasks that we throw at them, but I don't see this relationship to disappear anytime soon. Now, of course, this seems to be a key aspect also of GameGPT and many, you know, next generation tools like Copilot. We have mentioned that a number of times also on this show, you know, when it comes to development of IT systems and data engineer systems and data science, machine learning, etc., in many sectors. I guess my question is, how do you envision this collaborative relationship evolving in the future? And again, what are the potential benefits? We have mentioned some of them already, for example, saving time. But do you foresee other potential benefits for game development teams and not just the single developer?
I can speak to the coding benefits, which I think will continue to grow. For a team, I think one challenge is when you're working sort of individually to then like sort of synchronize your work and make sure that it all fits together. It could be useful to, for example, have an AI act as like a game reviewer with a special eye towards some of that. I could see that being useful. I think over time, we're also going to see improvements just in the overall quality of generation from a lot of these language models. So I think, for example, like context will continue to improve. The context window length will continue to grow. I think there's now a Gemini model with like a million token context window. I think that these LLMs are also going to become increasingly human in terms of giving responses that fit with what we as humans would expect them to give. And so I can see that also becoming beneficial. Maybe you have the language model operate as sort of like, not just like a co-pilot, but also giving suggestions right, like along the way as you work, or maybe acting as sort of an outside perspective in like a team discussion about a feature, maybe giving it a persona to act as a player and say, hey, this sounds like a cool thing to develop, but do you guys think that as a player, I would want, you know, whatever. And I think also they're just going to continue to improve at handling like more complicated tasks. And so when you combine all this together, I could definitely see a scenario where you essentially give an entire repository to a language model and say, hey, we'd like to open source this. Like, you know, what are some of the first suggestions that you think people would have about how to improve our code, for example? Right. So I think there's just a lot of opportunity there. But I'll let Jim talk a little bit about the more asset driven, sort of art driven side of things.
Yeah, I think what you said about the, you know, the gradual, I guess, rising quality and that sort of thing, that's definitely, I think that's, we're in store for that, or that's in store for us, rather. And even with like the 3D and meshes and geometry, it's not safe from I use that word safe, you know, but it is really cool that all the generation and automation, it is quite impressive. But right now it's not that impressive with 3D stuff, because the 3D stuff is kind of cool in this way that it is like an art form. It is artistic, but it also is kind of technical. And there's something there's edge flow. And what is good edge flow? Well, you know it when you see it. And what's bad edge flow? That's pretty bad when you have bad edge flow, honestly. And it's not really something that is easily quantified. So it's like it's a quality, in a way. But I'm sure it'll be honed in on soon enough. But as of yet, the 3D, the what would we call them? 3D implicit functions, right? They're not so impressive. So the 3D artists are they're fine for now, but in the long term, they've got to figure something out, I guess.
Can you discuss a bit some of the, let's say, real world applications or case studies where artificial intelligence has in fact been implemented or tested, and what were the outcomes, if you remember by heart?
Yeah. So actually, a lot of these are just what I'm about to mention are just like papers that I've reviewed in the last few weeks, which is pretty exciting because there's always new examples being added. But I think DeepMind's SEMA is a pretty interesting one. They have been exploring basically using language commands to basically have an AI play a video game. And this research was focused on 3D games. So for example, like Valheim or Minecraft. And they actually found that the skills that were developed by the AI to play some of these 3D games were actually extendable to games it had not even played. So for example, they could say like, go chop down the tree, and it would be able to do that in Minecraft, and then they would turn it loose in another game, and it would be able to also go chop down a tree if the game had that mechanic. And so there's some really good stats from the DeepMind team, who I think write some of the best papers and also non-technical explanations, where they go into this model and talk about like what are some potential applications for it, which I thought was really cool. And another one that's in a similar vein, it's a bit of an older paper. I say that it's been less than a year, I think, but it was a model called Voyager, which is a language model that can play Minecraft basically like a human. And there, I think most interesting thing was that Voyager could actually unlock items in the tech tree and discover new crafting recipes on its own, which is really cool because at least to us, it looks a little bit like learning, right? Where it's sort of discovering and figuring things out in the game world. So in both cases, like there was a lot of data generated around how fast the models could learn. In the Voyager case, there's a very interesting chart floating around that's on my website as well, that sort of shows the unlocking and progression of various technologies over time with this model compared to some other ones. And I don't know what the ultimate end goal of these sort of game-focused AI capabilities are. Obviously, one potential extrapolation is turning them loose in the real world, since a lot of these games mimic things we do in real life. It could be interesting to like give them physical hardware and sort of turn these models loose, or maybe a bit scary, depending on your perspective. But another more mundane benefit could just be like creating like streaming content that's fully automated, right? If there's a game that doesn't have a large community, I could see very easily setting up an AI agent to play the game. And another one to, record what's on the screen and add commentary to it. And suddenly you've automated like 50% of all Twitch streamers. So there's some pretty interesting and disruptive concepts that I think are just around the corner for these. But those are the two most relevant ones in this sort of game area that I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah. No, we are throwing ideas here, and of course, we call dibs on that.
Yeah, of course.
No, you made me smile when you said that it's an old paper, the Voyager one. It's 1 year. It's yeah, like, where right. are we going, guys?
We're going so fast.
Yeah, which is very true. I mean, after a couple of weeks, in fact, something is considered kind of obsolete because something else came up. So imagine 1 year is like ages in LLM time. All right. Well, guys, I have one last question for both of you, in fact. It would be nice to have, you know, different perspectives on this. You know, as game developers yourselves, can you, let's say, advise something for the developers who are interested in exploring artificial intelligence-driven approaches to game development? You know, what advice would you offer, and also what resources or tools you recommend for getting started? And please don't take me wrong when I say AI-driven approaches to game development. Feel free to start from game development, because I guess that's a step that nobody can skip for sure.
I guess you know, don't be afraid to use the AI. And I mean, I use like ChatGPT, or now they have like, you can just kind of Google an AI and you'll get some pretty pertinent advice, generally speaking. But you don't want it to usurp the throne, as it were, right? It shouldn't be in the driver's seat for these creative endeavors. That's defeating the purpose. So and then the other thing is that at least as it is right now, is you still need to know you know, if you're going to implement something and you're going to get the instructions from the AI, you still basically need to have an understanding that is at least adjacent to what it would require to come up with it originally. So it's not like a silver bullet where you can just not do any thinking, right? So things to keep in mind. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I have some more general, I guess, insight. I think the most important thing is to just try something. If you're thinking about trying to create a game, then if you know nothing, you can make progress in almost any direction. And it's somewhat liberating, I think, if you're just starting out like any sort of technical endeavor, because you're unencumbered by preconceptions about what you can and can't do. Of course, you'll develop those over time as you learn. But the biggest opportunity early on is to just try things. And that's basically what Jim and I did. I think the second thing I would say is you should allow yourself to become obsessed with your vision for whatever it is that you're creating. I think a lot of people fail to create a game or any sort of technical thing because they give up after a short amount of time and lack maybe some of the discipline necessary to fully push an idea that they really believe in all the way to the end. And obsession is actually a form of discipline, I think. And so if you really get obsessed with a game idea or a website or something else, then you can kind of use that obsession to overcome the tendency to give up. And I think the last thing is just maybe be very clear about the goals and expectations for your projects, and don't change them without a great reason. And if you do change them, do it very rarely. This project has been a 2-year project for Jim and I, and we said we would, you know, release it for free. We weren't going to make a ton of money off of it or anything like that. It was mostly just a creative thing that we wanted to do and see through to the end, because we really loved the idea and we thought that there should be a game like this, and we couldn't find one anywhere else. So that's kept us going for a very long time, and we've been working on it for free for such a long time now that we just want to see it done and out there and have people play it and have fun with it. So we never changed those goals. And I think that's part of the reason we've been able to work on it for so long, is we stuck to that vision. We didn't allow it to become some big financial project or some big time commitment where we would give up, you know, our jobs and just work on it. And so actually, in a lot of ways, having that very clear scope I think has kept the project on track. So if that worked for us, maybe it'll work for you.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm very glad to hear this from both of you guys. And I want to add that, of course, you know, discipline is indeed a very important factor of any developers, but even more so for video game developments that are usually, you know, relatively complex projects because it's a combination of many things. We have not even touched, you know, or spoken about the physics, for example. Probably we need another episode for that.
right. Yeah, we can get into all of that.
Yeah, so this is definitely, we are not even scratching the surface of game development in this episode for sure. Now, there is one thing that I want to add, probably the fact that, you know, many wannabe developers, so to speak, or those who are not yet familiar with development in general, they want to get close to game development, which is fun because, you know, if you're a gamer yourself, you're probably, you know, kind of personal curiosity is like, okay, how did they do that? Like, I spend like 12 hours of my day on this game, probably. How is it done? So there is that curiosity that is driven by curiosity for sure. There's another thing that is very important. Tools have improved a lot. And that technical barrier that we had several years ago is definitely lower today. So, plus AI, I mean, guys, just throw yourself on video game development. that's the message. Cool. Yeah.
With this barrier being so low, there are much fewer excuses than there used to be because you can start and stop so easily. So you should not let the technology prohibit you from trying something. It's getting easier all the time.
Don't underestimate the number of things that can go wrong, especially, you know, in keeping in mind, you know, just try it, go out there, do it. If you, if you have a mind for developing a game of your own, but it can, a lot of things go wrong, but yeah.
of course. No, but that's a very good take home message. And so, of course, we're going to annotate all this in the show notes of this episode with some of the most interesting and important links of things we have discussed in this episode today with Mike and Jim. Guys, thank you so much for being here. I'm pretty sure that the listeners of Data Science at Home podcast will appreciate your episode today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, we hope they enjoy it. Thanks.
And if you made it until here, well, congratulations. You have just unlocked the Master of Data Science achievement for surviving another episode of Data Science at Home podcast. Thank you so much, and of course, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. It's free of charge, and you will find the link on the official website, datascienceathome.com. Till next time.